what that means, what it is. One of the definitions I came up with for empathy is the ability to understand and share the feelings of another or of others. As Christians, we are to be imitators of God and have compassion for one another. We need to try to put ourselves in other people's shoes, because sometimes that can feel a lot different. From Scripture, we see the great empathy Jesus showed for all kinds of people, for the sick, the blind, the deaf, the outcasts, lepers, just a lot of different type of people. And throughout Scripture, we're taught to be humble and to look at the interests of others, look out for the interests of others, as much or more as our own. We're to bear the burden of our brothers and sisters in Christ, and we always need to remember there's one body of Christ, but each of us is a part of that body. And we're to love one another and to be sensitive to the feelings of others. We should all pray that these scriptures, and we need to be praying for each other and remember that it's not just what I think, the way I see things, the way I feel is maybe the right way, isn't the only right way. There's lots of other ways. And the way we respond, the way we act to other people, the words we say when we're interacting with people are all part of empathy and how we make others feel. Theodore Roosevelt made the comment that nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Empathy is born out of the old biblical injunction, love thy neighbor as thyself. I'd like to look at some scriptures that talk about empathy, different things. Matthew 22 says, Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Galatians 5:14, for the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. 1 Peter 3:8 says, finally, all of you should be of one mind. Sympathize with each other. Love each other as brothers and sisters. Be tenderhearted, and keep an humble attitude. Hebrews 4:13-16. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Galatians 5:22-23, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. Matthew 7:12, therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, Do you even so to them? For this is the law and the prophets. Luke 6:31 says, do to others as you would have them do to you. A lot of these are familiar scriptures to us, but I think it's just good for us to hear them again, because repetition, I think, helps us to just have a better understanding of God's word and helps us be able to remember it better. I'd like to give you a bit of an illustration of how not using empathy can affected this person, and then a different scenario of how it could have been and probably and how it should have been. And then I'd like to open it up for some interaction from you on comments that you have thoughts concerning empathy. So this is just an example. It's not not necessarily something that happened. So I get up in the morning and I'm eating breakfast with my family. My daughter knocks over a cup of coffee onto my shirt. I have no control over what just happened. What happens next will be determined by how I react. And by the way, there's something called the 90-10 secret. So we technically don't have control over 10% of what happens to us every day in life, but we do have control over the 90% of the rest of the day. And that's what tends to make the difference in how our day actually ends up being. So, I react. I harshly scold my daughter for knocking the coffee cup over. She breaks down in tears. After scolding her, I turn to my spouse and criticize her for placing the cup too close to the edge of the table. It's always someone else's fault. A short verbal battle follows. I storm upstairs and change my shirt. Back downstairs, I find my daughter has been too busy crying to finish her breakfast and get ready for school. She misses the bus because of this. My spouse must leave immediately for work. I rush to the car and drive my daughter to school because I'm late. I drive 40 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour speed zone. So we know what can happen with that kind of a thing. I have a miserable day at work, but I'm not sure why. Everything seems to go wrong. I look forward to going home. When I arrive home, I find there are small wedges between my relationship with my wife and my daughter. Why? Because of how I reacted in the morning. Why did I have a bad day? Did the coffee cause it? Did my daughter cause it? Or did my colleagues cause it? Or did I cause it? Of course, the answer is I caused it. Now let's see how this could have played out. Again, I don't have control over what happened with the coffee cup. But how I react, I do have control over. So, the coffee splashes on my shirt. My daughter's about to cry. I gently say, "It's okay, honey. You just need to be more careful next time." I rush upstairs. After grabbing a new shirt and my briefcase, I come back down in time to look through the window and see my child getting on the bus. She turns and waves. I kiss my wife and go to work. I arrive 5 minutes early and cheerfully greet the staff. My boss comments on how good of a day I'm having. Notice the difference? Two different scenarios, both started the same but ended differently. Why? Because of how I reacted. So, comments from you, experiences, thoughts, whatever you might have. Quiet bunch tonight. It could be. That's correct.
Is empathy partly learning to understand what someone else is going through? And probably the easiest, the purest when we have already walked a mile in the sun.
Gary? Harry?
I agree that it's inevitable we often think of...
I think he's got a mic for you.
I agree that in empathy, we often think of walking with somebody through something we've already walked through. It is also true that Paul starts his second letter to the Corinthians, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." And so in that sense, the fact that we are all children of God, we have all received comfort from God, allows us to empathize with people who are going through things we have not gone through, with the comfort wherewith we are comforted by God.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Laverne?
Well, empathy, we usually think of words, of course, because words are the vehicle by which we communicate, and sometimes saying back to someone what they have told us helps them to understand that, yes, we actually heard what they said. But empathy can also be as simple as an understanding look or a glance, even that of maybe if a person is in a predicament, maybe a knowing smile instead of a frown, for example.
Sure. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you for those comments. I have one other, something else I'd like to read yet. I think illustrates very well how this lady, I guess I can call her a lady, didn't act, how she was so full of herself, and how I think the outcome will, I'll just read it, and then it was back in the time when racism and things like that were probably a little bit bigger issue than they are now, although it's still prevalent. On a British Airways flight from Johannesburg, a middle-aged, well-off, white South African lady had found herself sitting next to a black man. She called the cabin crew attendant over to complain about her seating. "What seems to be the problem, madam?" asked the attendant. "K "Can't you see," she said, "you've sat me next to a Kaffir. I can't possibly sit next to this disgusting human. Find me another seat." "Please calm down, madam," the flight attendant replied. "The flight is very full today, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go and check to see if we have any seats available in club or first class." The woman cocks a snooty look at the outraged black man beside her, not to mention many of the surrounding passengers. A few minutes later, the flight attendant returns with the good news, which she delivers to the lady, who cannot help but look at the people around her with a smug and self-satisfied grin. "Madam, unfortunately, as I suspected, economy class is full. I've spoken to the cabin services director, and club is full as well. Fortunately, we do have one seat available in first class." Before the lady had a chance to answer, the flight attendant continues, "It is most extraordinary to make this kind of upgrade. However, and I have had to get special permission from the captain, but given the circumstances, the captain felt that it was outrageous that someone be forced to sit next to such an obnoxious person." With which she turned to the black man sitting next to her and said, "So, if you'd like to get your things, sir, I have a seat ready for you." At which point, apparently the surrounding passengers stood and gave a standing ovation while the black man walked up to the front of the plane. So, let's remember that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Thank you. Braden?
Good evening. Well, when they asked me to speak about something I was passionate about, I thought the obvious answer would be Anna. But I thought maybe you guys wouldn't want to listen to me speak for 20 minutes about her. So there are two issues that I am passionate about, and those are what I would like to address tonight. They aren't clearly connected, but I think they can be combined because it combats both the issues effectively. The first problem is that there are so many things to invest our time, energy, and money into these days. Some of them are clearly wrong, but so many of them are seemingly neutral, and quite a few are good. We tend to, too often, invest in the neutral and the less good rather than the best. The second problem is that in today's world, we can live a successful life without relying on God. I'll define successful later. Without relying on God and without devoting our lives to Him and without serving Him. I believe there's a solution that combats both of these quite effectively, and it is a two-part solution. We need to change our main goal, and in that, we need to shift from a defensive Christian lifestyle to an offensive Christian lifestyle. So let me explain the first problem. Because of how successful American society has been and for how long has been experienced peace, and simply because we live in a world with so many people with so many different interests, there are so many things and activities that we can invest in. As has been the case throughout history, we need to decide what we are going to invest in. I think it is clear that choosing activities that go against what God has said is wrong, and so is therefore sin. However, I suggest that we can sin even if the activity we are choosing is not inherently wrong. If we choose to do something that is neutral or even slightly less good, then we would be doing something that is, rather than doing something that is really good or even the best, we are choosing good over the best. And I think in many cases that can be sin. The second problem is The world and its culture, and even parts of Christian culture in America, can cause us to believe that we are living successfully without giving our lives to God and living for Him. Now, obviously, this hinges on our definition of success. I will go with what I think the world's definition is, and then I will go with what I think the definition is for many Christians in America. These are my perceptions that are probably biased and could very well be inaccurate, but I think the point still stands. The world, or more specifically, American culture, says that success is measured by happiness and pleasure. The more time you are able to spend in leisure, entertainment, fulfilling earthly passions, and other ways to bring yourself pleasure and therefore happiness, the more successful you are. Success is also measured by how much power someone has, which is also heavily influenced by money. So, the American definition of success is having the capability to spend extensive amounts of time and energy in leisure and entertainment and having influence or other forms of power over other people, all of which are directly affected by money. My perception of the American Christian definition of success is having and being all those things that the American definition was, but also going to church, having a family and friends, and being an upstanding citizen. Not a full definition, but still part of it. This definition, like the other, is judged primarily externally. The main goal of this viewpoint, as far as God and Christianity are concerned, is to, at its best, make it to heaven. And sometimes, at its worst, just get out of hell. Stay out of hell. A subtle but critical difference between the two. So, to accomplish this goal, all we really have to do is stay away from egregious sin. And I believe, for the most part, if we have a solid backbone, keep ourselves away from bad influences, and have a general idea of right and wrong, we can be successful by this definition, largely without the help of God. Not completely, obviously, since He's the only reason that we are living right now. Let me explain myself. With a basic amount of training and self-discipline, we can have a relatively good-paying job. If we have a basic amount of social awareness and social adeptness, we can have friends and we can have influence on people. With a little self-discipline and some peer pressure, we can show up to church every Sunday. With really no influence or any self-discipline of any sort, we can spend time and energy making ourselves happy in whatever form that we prefer. With a little self-discipline and money spending, we can have a house and several cars and so on. And with a basic knowledge of the Bible and some self-discipline there as well, we can stay away from sin, or so we think. A caveat here. I want to be clear that I am very grateful for all these basic trainings and skill sets that I have been taught and given. And I'm not saying that if you truly rely on God, that you won't have those skill sets and that training. However, my argument is that it is very possible to have that training and those skill sets without relying on God. Now let's take a look at how our main goals in life shape us. From what I have seen and from my experience, our main goal is what decides what we do and don't do, and what we are and what we are not. As hard as we try to tell ourselves to do something or not do something, in the end, our main goal, what we are striving for above all else, in this case success, will decide whether we do something or don't do something. Sports analogies really connect with me. If they don't for you, bear with me. Let's say someone's main goal is to be the best that he can at Madden, in a video game. However, he also wants to be an athlete and wants to be really good at sports. He may try to watch what he eats and work out and practice sports, and he might have success at times in this. However, in the end, he will prioritize researching strategies for his video game or practicing different finger patterns to get better at his video game because they are working towards his main goal. Even though he wants to be an athlete, and even though working out and watching what he eats is good, they will all eventually get pushed out because they aren't helping him accomplish his main goal. In the same way, if our main goal is to succeed, by our previous definition, then we will do things that help us accomplish relative wealth, comfort, influence, or power. So even though we know that we should spend time with God and that we shouldn't sin, neither of these things are clearly and directly helping us accomplish our goals. I think this phenomenon of our main goal driving us and making our decisions for us is natural and healthy, and I don't think we should try to change that. But I think that this lifestyle is problematic. So the solution that I propose is that we change our main goal. We should change it from being successful, by whatever definition that may be, to bringing God's kingdom to earth now. There's a pretty strong biblical basis for this goal. One of the most obvious places is in the Lord's Prayer when he says, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This can be viewed as a future and prophetic looking ahead to when Jesus will return, which is a valid interpretation, I think. But I also think that Jesus is asking that God would bring his kingdom to earth now, at the present time. I just finished reading Ben-Hur. For those of you who don't know, it's a story of a Jew who lived at the same time as Jesus and whose family was imprisoned and enslaved by the Romans. In this book, I realized once again how big a disappointment Jesus' life on earth was to so many Jews. Many were aware and believed that he was the promised Messiah, but that he was the king come to save them from the Romans and establish a new, powerful Israelite kingdom. However, they were disappointed when his message didn't seem to align with that, and their spirits were crushed when the very people they thought he was going to overthrow killed their king. Jesus made it very clear that he was the promised king, and he was coming to establish a kingdom on earth. However, it was and is a kingdom unlike any earthly kingdom. It is God's kingdom, whose laws are love and life everlasting. And Jesus not only taught this, he spent his whole life spreading and establishing that kingdom wherever he went. And his final plea to his disciples and to us was to continue that work and continue to spread and establish God's kingdom here on earth today. So, like I said, I don't think we should try to change the fact that we will do things that help us accomplish our main goals. Rather, I think we should make our goal to establish and spread God's kingdom. And there are several sub-goals that follow naturally from this main goal. First, have a close relationship with God. To build God's kingdom, we need to know what his kingdom consists of and who the king is. To do this, we must have a relationship with him. Secondly, get as many people to join the kingdom as possible, since if our goal is to spread it, then the more people we get, the better. When this is our main goal, the second part of the solution comes into play. It shifts from a defensive Christian lifestyle to an offensive Christian lifestyle. This is once again sports terminology, and I apologize again if you don't connect with it. But to explain what I mean, in a sport, offense is when your team is attempting to score, and defense is when your team is attempting to keep the other team from scoring. Let's take basketball, for example. Offense or defense is defined by which end of the court you are on. If you're on the end of your basket, your main goal is to make it. If you're on the end of the other team's basket, then your main goal is to keep them from making it into the goal. Defense is crucial to a game. However, a team will not win if they only play defense. And they may keep the score low, but they will likely eventually let things slide on their end because it's very hard to stay motivated to play only defense. In the previously mentioned lifestyle, as far as Christianity is concerned, we are only on the defensive. Granted, we are trying to win, which in this case is make it to heaven, but our means to accomplish that is purely defensive. We try not to disobey God and his rules, but what it truly comes down to, the main thing we do is try not to sin. And we do that by sitting around and trying to ward off the temptations when they come our way. We aren't really doing anything. We are trying to not do something. We end up making our focus to keep ourselves from doing different things, which, as in the case of sports, it becomes really hard to maintain motivation for this because you never are attempting to do anything or accomplish anything. Eventually, we give in to sin, and more regularly and likely, as sin of this lifestyle will have it, our motivation to live slowly dwindles. However, when we make our main goal to bring God's kingdom to earth now, our lifestyle and strategy shifts dramatically to offense. We are trying to accomplish something, And so we take clear steps to accomplish that goal. And anything that is detrimental to that goal is, without much thought or effort, disregarded. It may even be a conscious decision, because it may not even be a conscious decision, because there are so many things that we can do to accomplish the goal that anything that is harmful or even neutral simply doesn't fit into our life. Therefore, not only do we follow Jesus' call, an example to spread and establish God's kingdom on earth, we also naturally turn away from sin. It simply doesn't have a place in that lifestyle. And from my experience, it is shocking how sin problems can almost disappear because they just don't make sense anymore. And not only does it make us stay away from clear sin, it also keeps us from the more subtle sin of neutral activities, things that aren't inherently bad or wrong in any way. With this offensive lifestyle, we can quickly decipher what is the most effective way to accomplish our goal. And anything that is less effective gets thrown out. So, neutral and lesser good things, without much thought, are disregarded. So to summarize, we should shift our goal from being successful to spreading and establishing God's kingdom here on earth now. When we do that, we naturally separate ourselves from sin, our priorities fall into place, and we become motivated to live. A disclaimer, these are all generalizations of both the problems and the solutions, and these problems won't be pertinent to everyone, and these mindset changes as solutions will not solve everything for everyone. However, I will say that these shifts of thinking about this have been very helpful for me, and I propose that if you look carefully at these things in your life, it can be helpful for you as well. This has all been very theoretical up until now, so I would like to offer some practical ways to aid this mental shift. Once again, this may not work for you, but it has been helpful for me and has been what I've learned from others. To change our main goal from whatever it may be to spreading and establishing God's kingdom, we must first identify what our main goal was. Then we must become aware of all the ways it was affecting us. Although this switch is a mental switch, our physical actions affect our mindset. So we need to feed and nourish the main goal that we are longing for by actively doing things that accomplish it, even if it isn't coming from a heart that genuinely wants to. That may mean attending community or church meetings of prayer and worship, or spending time by ourselves with God and in His Word, or serving your neighbors, or whatever it may be. By doing these things, we are showing ourselves and proving to ourselves that we value what these things are trying to accomplish. And with persistence, I believe that we can go from making ourselves do these things to show ourselves that we value the main goal of spreading God's kingdom, to adopting a goal and naturally choosing to do those things because they help us accomplish the goal we have adopted. If we look at every single decision that we make as an opportunity to attack and to help accomplish our main goal, then it can make it easier to decipher and to choose the best option. I think I'm out of time for questions, but I would love to discuss this with any of you at any time and would love to hear your wisdom on these issues. Joe.
Well, good evening. I am interested in, I was interested in hearing the previous two little talks and seeing how some of the commonality there in the mindset, the values expressed. A few weeks ago, Twyla and I spent an evening with Lowell and Rita Peachy, and when we get together, we never have enough time to talk, and we talk a blue streak till it's time to quit. In the course of the evening, we came across some of the values that that we feel important in the way of community and possessions and so on. And I mentioned that here in a few weeks, I'm going to be given about 20 minutes to rant about something I'm passionate about. Ranting is not what I have any inclination to do. Lowell said, "That sounds interesting. I'd like to know when that is, and I want to be there." So I'm honored to have Lowell and Rita here this evening. I would just say this, while we have many common interests, I happen to know that Lowell loves the stage, and I don't. So there's a big difference between the two of us. I'd like to talk a little about community this evening and how we view community. Now, if I come across sounding like an old geezer who's pining for the good old days, just bear with me. There is some of that in me. There are so many things about the way we lived when I was growing up that have shaped the way I think and act today. And if I come across at some point as sounding a little cynical or critical or something like that, please bear with me. I don't think that's in my heart. What I love to do is spark some really good discussion. We might have a little time for a little feedback here this evening, but what would mean even a lot more to me is if you engage in discussion about things that have to do with the things we value, and have a willingness to poke each other a little bit, perhaps challenge each other a little bit to both teach and to learn. So that's my wish. In my growing up days, as you have probably heard me say before, and perhaps from this spot, we depended a lot on each other's skills, tools, equipment, labor, and so on. There was a group of us that shared a baler, and we each had our own wagons. We had a bale elevator, and the only way we had moved from handling loose hay to small square bales. The loose hay I don't remember, but putting up small square bales was really a lot of hard work compared to the way we put up hay today. And so I spent many hours with Titus and Tim and Larry and Phil and JR putting up hay. My brother David was part of that too. And we still talk about some of the things that happened. Now, I'll assure you that not everything was pleasant. It would not be real life if everything had just been hunky-dory. I see Titus grinning. I thought about mentioning or telling a little story about something that happened probably 55 years ago, that only surfaced again in recent years. But I'm going to not take the time for that. And if you want to ask Titus or me, we're probably thinking the same thing. Well, we've moved from a place of being very dependent on each other and sharing labor freely and expecting that it would be returned. There would be an evening of settling up and so on. But we've moved from that day to, or that model to being independent. There's something about being independent that I do like. That's not all gravy either. Today, I went to a job with a baler. There was another one already there waiting for an operator, and 8 bales into the job, and it's a large one. The pickup on my baler self-destructed. It wasn't just a bearing going out. It really destroyed itself. So it made a trip back to the shop, and tomorrow that's going to be what is on our plate instead of having 2 balers in the field. The pressure that comes from those kind of little happenings, it can be pretty demoralizing. And we get feeling pretty, some days, we mostly have good days. But when we have several of these and the pressure is on, we get to feeling pretty miserable. I love to interact with my neighbors. One day, when we were having a day sort of like we're going to have tomorrow, I saw Myron Bontrager working across the road from us, just directly east of us, at our neighbors. And Myron likes to farm, but his gift is more in the way of cabinetry and fine skills like that. And so that's where he is spending most of his time. But I was looking across the road thinking about how pleasant it would be to just be installing a countertop and working by myself and waiting for the next, get to the next job when you can. There's no hay out there that's waiting to be destroyed by adverse weather. And I ended up envying him. Later, Myron told me he was looking out the window and thinking, how did Joe get his dream job? So that is a true story. It happened just that way. We all have the things we love, and there are some things that come with it that are not so pleasant. I did discover, taking too long on stories here, I see. I did discover that his day wasn't going so great, because as he was running the router, trimming the piece of Formica, he didn't notice, it had to be trimmed before it was glued down, he didn't notice that it was creeping away from the wall. And you know what happens when he's cutting the front edge? It destroyed it. So the job had to be left unfinished, and he had to order another piece of Formica, and the neighbors had to put up with an unfinished top for a while until it could be finished. So there's a little bunny trail. Well, from independence, it's easy to move to a place of competing with each other. And that's one of the things that really concerns me about community. That's not that that can be that can be destructive. And so while we probably won't return to sharing balers, I hope we can guard against becoming so independent and so competitive and so intent on staying abreast or even getting ahead of other people. I hope we don't lose the ability to empathize with people who are struggling and who are having difficulty meeting obligations. Shifting just a little bit here, I attended several Anabaptist financial seminars. It's something I have felt that Mennonites are especially good at is, while I mentioned the competitiveness, we also do well at helping each other become more wealthy, if it doesn't compete with our own interests too badly. I went to that first seminar feeling just a little cynical. I was wondering if this is going to be more sessions about how to become wealthy and then use that wealth in a good way, because that really is something that makes us feel good. It is more difficult, I believe, to forego the wealth in the first place and take the extra time, bear the extra cost of ministering to local needs. And that may be just a neighbor. That may be, you know, anyone. Well, I was tremendously encouraged at the emphasis. I actually don't recall anything that was said about how to help each other become wealthy. There was a lot said about kingdom building and a lot said about even the pitfalls of a great deal of wealth. I'll tell you a little story. One of the presenters asked Benji Mast to come from where he was sitting back there, close to the aisle, up to a point behind him on the stage. The thing is, he had a knife in his hand. In a position of in an offensive position, Benji took the long way around and came up, bypassed him a very, very safe distance, and he asked, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Well, because of the danger." The point the speaker was making is that we are duly warned about the pitfalls of wealth. And he said, "Why do we insist on taking the hard way?" That has stuck with me. I was blessed with that little illustration. On Sunday, if you'll remember, David mentioned that Covetousness is the only sin of the spirit mentioned in the Ten Commandments. I found that interesting. And Twyla just pointed that out to me while we were sitting here. And yes, indeed, I remembered it, and I hadn't made that connection. I hadn't applied that to what I was the topic I was thinking about here. We have lots of opportunities to gain in the things we purchase, purchasing properties, expanding our businesses, and so on. I am concerned that in that drive, we don't fall into covetousness. I think covetousness can be pretty easily disguised, and I think, you know, what not all things that are lawful are expedient. It is quite lawful to use certain business practices to get our own way. If we examine our attitudes, we may find that we're actually violating some scriptural principles in our attitude. Let's see, kind of lost my train of thought here. All right, I'll go to a little story that Gary Miller tells, that this is the writer and speaker. We also have a writer and speaker, Gary Miller, with us here. And this is the other Gary Miller. Gary told the story of a man in his growing up years whose father was in the gas station business. He had his own service station. He was the type of person who never saw the... he really didn't have an appetite for a lot of growth and expansion, and so his business stayed small. There were other gas stations around. And I like this little neighbor of mine. We interact a lot on our mile. Eventually, this Jerry's father passed away, and with the inheritance of some wealth and the gas station, he put his dream to work. He bought another gas station and another and another, and he saw his opportunity to expand to trucking gas to his own stations and then to others. And he saw stations that he would like to buy that people were that weren't for sale. So his tactic then became to lower prices at the stations close to the others that he didn't own in order to put a financial squeeze on them. And he succeeded in either driving them out of business or bringing them to the point where they were willing to sell. I think a good way for us to sort of evaluate our own heart, our own motives, is to think about how we view the competition and what we do to the competition. Are we willing to see them, to put them in a difficult spot because that's good for business on our part? Or would we actually consider going out of our way to help someone else be successful, even if they might compete with us? None of us likes to be left out. None of us likes to be run over. And so I thought that story was expressed what I would like to, the kind of values, I guess, that I don't want to have. The point that Gary made was really valuable. Now, I will probably shock you if I tell you that I am very wealthy. That happens to be a fact. Several years ago, my brother David preached a sermon here. Most of that sermon consisted of reading the book, The Global Village. There are those times when I am, when I sit completely engrossed in a good speech, a good sermon that's really, really hitting home with me. That happens to be one of those most memorable times. That's one of the more memorable sermons that that I have sat under, and there have been many, by the way. I have come to realize that we are in probably the top, maybe as high as the top 7% of the wealthiest people on earth. Now, that doesn't mean that we control that percentage of that wealth of those 7%. But the fact is that we have about 4 vehicles, maybe 5. We won't have a lot of discussion about what they're worth. If you see me driving around town, you may... I'll leave that to your judgment. You may guess, and I'd hope you will guess low. But the other truth is that we own about as many houses as we own vehicles. And that pushes us up pretty high in that bracket, you know, in comparing ourselves globally. But when I sit with people here, I don't feel very wealthy. In fact, of our constituents, nationwide, that would put me down probably pretty close to poverty in some people's opinion. But the truth is, when I hear disparaging comments about how we have trouble making it, the drought, and by the way, it is right that we pray for rain. We are dependent on the Lord, and we need rain, and it is a blessing from Him. But I have often said that we all have much more than we need. And it's good for us to have that constant awareness that we have more than we need. If we feel poor beside our neighbor, let's love our neighbor And let's not let those things put a division between us. As Larry was telling us, let's empathize. Where there are people who are having a difficult time, let's be able to feel that pain and not just assume that they're different and they probably don't hurt quite in the same way that we do. And I would say in parting that any given day, you will meet people who are having a really bad day. It takes so little sometimes to make them have a better day. Look for those opportunities. And it can be a smile. It can be a small compliment. Just showing them in some way that you care. And that will help them have a better day. And you will probably be remembered for it. All right. We are at closing time. John, did you have a course for us? All right. And you will be dismissed after that.